Welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. We are coming to you from our top secret headquarters at Project Quantum Leap, but you can find us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And please do us a favor by hitting the subscribe button on iTunes. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. Fate's Wide Wheel. Top secret project in Chicago. I mean, Quantum, I don't know. Anyway.
Here we are.
So yeah, Dennis, do you want to introduce our special guest this week?
Yes, our guest this week is Kathleen Gibson. I always mean to ask our special guest, like, how you would like to be introduced, especially entertainers, like, if you have any gigs or anything coming up that you want to promote.
Unfortunately, no. Wait, what do I have? No, I do like 7,000 things. I'm a music director. I've been doing a lot of that lately, and I'm an improviser, and I do musical theater, so nothing immediately coming up. I'm with the group Chico's Chaps. We do, like, cabaret-style improv, and my friend dresses in drag, and we're just, like, ladies who work at a Chico's who wrote musicals in the 80s. It's a lot of fun.
That sounds awesome.
And then they're like, oh, you guys know our hits. What was that musical? And then we improvise songs from our musicals.
Musical improv is such a talent that I did not take the time to cultivate when I was an improviser.
Yeah. It's so fun. It's my favorite. Oh, and I'm in Baby Wants Candy. Duh. You can come see Baby Wants Candy Saturdays at Second City.
Well,
I was like, speaking of music improv.
That's a big deal.
Yeah. Guys, I'm a huge deal. You're welcome.
I'm like, that
we
was
great.
That was like
by your presence.
That was like one of the first shows that I saw when I got to Chicago 12 years ago. And that
nice.
I saw them when they were still part of I.O.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's my favorite show to do in Chicago. It's so fun. There's a full band, and it's a fully improvised musical. We get a title of the show, and then we just go. And I play in the band as well, so I'm on stage and off.
Heck yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome.
So it's like, and it's, I won't say it's equally as fun, because I like performing more.
Okay.
But it's still so, like, leading a band and, like,
oh, absolutely.
You know, a drummer, and our drummer, Chris Ditton, is amazing. Sometimes there's another one. It's usually Chris. He's the best. We have a handful of really good guitarists, so the band is always killer. It's just fun.
At Second City?
Now we're at Second City, and sometimes we're in the Beat Lounge, and sometimes we're in the Skybox. But they are the best, and I love doing it.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, I have a couple of excuses. Unfortunately, Jess and I haven't been to Second City in far too long, so now I have some good reasons to get my butt over there.
Get back there.
If you're lucky, I'll come up here.
Ooh.
Just watch out. Save you that $12.
Is it a late night show or is it a primetime show?
No, it's like 9, I think. They just switched the schedules in some of the smaller theaters because they used to all have the shows all at 9. Mm-hmm. Like it was 7:30, 9, 10:30. And now they've staggered them so that the house staff can get their heads together.
Wow.
So.
Cool. One of my most commercially successful, not artistically successful, shows were in Donny Skybox.
Yeah.
And my first year in the city. And it just, because we were like Saturday night, 9 o'clock. The show was not great, but the main stage and ETC were constantly selling out. So out of town tourists, they wanted to see a quote Second City show.
Yeah.
They've got funneled.
In,
they got funneled to us. And,
the new Skybox is amazing. They revamped it. So it's like, it looks like a smaller main stage.
Okay.
It's cool.
Awesome. Fantastic. And so to bring us around, Kathleen, how many episodes of Quantum Leap have you seen?
One. Just this one!
And speaking of which, the episode is Thou Shalt Not, which was written by Tammy Adder and directed by Randy Roberts. It originally aired on November the 16th, 1989. Our leap date is February the 2nd, 1974, and Sam has leapt into David Bosch, and who is a rabbi, and gives us one of the more classic oh boy moments
in the series. Yes.
Oy vey,
I'm the rabbi. Yes. So the TV guide description, like we do, Sam leaps into a rabbi's life and must prevent his sister-in-law from having an affair that would break up his brother's fragile family.
I think even the TV guide, I just want to say this right off the bat, I think the TV guide description does a good job of setting this up, honestly, too. This episode feels very much like a melodrama to me, and I don't mean that in a bad way, though.
No.
Like, it's really well done.
It was really
well liked this episode. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have strong memories of this episode from when I watched it the first time around, seen it in repeats, etc. I probably have seen it a number of times, you know, like, I would say like 4 or 5 times at least, if not more. I really like it. I like the acting, I like the writing, I like the direction. There's some shots in this episode where I'm just sort of like, man, you were going a little bit above and beyond. Like, even the lighting palette, I was like, they're really kind of like stepping up their game in a couple of these scenes. So so there you have it. That's all I'm going to say.
That's the setup there.
For now.
And for you, Kathleen, who has never seen an episode before, like, the one of the gimmicks of the show is that when Sam leaps in, he always says, oh boy.
Yes.
So this time it's boy they.
Well, that was my favorite thing is, it's like when you're in an improv scene and it's like, okay, it's Jewish. Let me think of the 4 things I know about Jewish people and then say them in a row. Like, we're immediately, we get an oy vey, and then we get you'll finish the knishes. And then they literally mention knishes like 3 times. Cause
yes.
Like, any other Jewish food? Can't think of it now. That's it. Matzah? Maybe? No, I don't think. But it's like, they think of like, it. I don't know if the author is a chosen person or not, but it felt like, it was like, here's the 6 things I know about Judaism. Let's put them all in a row.
Yes.
I don't know. That's a good question.
I mean,
that seems creepy
to, like,
to try and find
about
out
someone's religious
background. I was looking up the writer.
I'm sure some of the, I mean, like, you know, all the Hebrew seemed correct. Or, I mean, I don't know. I am not chosen, so I don't know, but.
I mean, to me, it's like, because I was, like, trying to, like, how much do I want to dive into, like, how much that they have accurate about this?
Yeah.
And it seemed
like the important stuff was, but it was, like, let's harp on this theme with the 4 things.
That we have, that we know. Yeah. Looking up the writer here, Tammy Adder, she was creator of a Whoopi Goldberg Strong Medicine on the Lifetime Network.
Oh, yeah.
Her credits include Dawson's Creek and The Wonder Years.
She did some stuff on The Commish and 30-something as well.
Good for her.
Party of 5. She wrote about 5 episodes of that.
I love Party of 5.
Oh. She also, it looks like, did about 10 episodes or so of Sisters, which is one of those shows that doesn't have, like, a super big following, but I thought that show was just great.
Was that a Swoozy Kurtz vehicle?
She was indeed in that.
Yes!
That was Celia Ward.
I just pulled that out of my butt!
Yeah!
You don't get to say Swoozy Kurtz vehicle very often.
No, you really don't.
Well, tag
but
that.
We need more Swoozy Kurtz vehicles, in my opinion.
Well, it's funny, too, because, oddly enough, though, the person that kind of hit it big out of that show would have been Celia Ward. Like, she was the one that got all the nominations, all the hype, all the, like, she was sort of, like, you know, the chosen one, if you will. Anyway.
Speaking of the chosen one.
Right? Sorry, there's a little background noise there, folks. Our top secret headquarters are located close enough to the street.
in Chicago.
So, Bat Mitzvah is occurring, and it's Sam's, the person he's leapt into, his niece.
Uh-huh.
This opening shot, one of the things that I really love about this is that we get, in the sequence of shots, rather, a story told to us without a lot of details, but it's there.
Yeah.
And we see Mom and Dad in the front pew, and Mom is so excited. Dad looks just vacant. Daughter / niece, just kind of vacant, numb as well. Just sort of like, okay, this is happening. You know, looking at her parents, they're looking at her, you know, and it's just sort of like, okay, something's going on here. You know, there's some sort of issue. They're in pain. And it's just really, really, really nicely done. And of course, then we get that 1-2 punch with the comedic moment with Sam, you know, the oy vey moment.
And we also get
set up really nicely.
We also get a mirror shot where we see that, the person who leaped into David. We haven't met Joe yet, but yes, it is very clear that him and Joe are brothers. Like,
they're
a couple different actors, like, they resemble each other.
And we get John J. Reiner is playing the mirror image, and then James Sartorius plays the brother Joe. Lindsay Fisher plays the daughter. She did a run on Roseanne for a while, actually. I remember her from Roseanne as Dana. But anyway, and then the wife played by Terry Hanauer. I don't have anything else right now queued up. I just wanted to get those names out there.
Put them out there like we do. And then we launch into the opening sequence, and then we come back. We are at the dinner, I guess, after the ceremony.
Yeah.
The reception, sort of.
The reception, yes. And that is such a fellowship hall.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Oh, the partition, everything, yeah.
And luckily, you know, Al arrives just in time to help Sam get through the breaking of the bread.
Mm-hmm.
So he feeds him the what to say, how to say it, and then goes on to tell him, of course, that it was his third wife, Ruth, who was Jewish, and so he, you know, learned all of this from her.
So I will stop and ask Kathleen, because we haven't gotten to a point. There's a certain point in the series where they have an opening narration sequence that they set up. They set up everything really well, including who Al is. But at this point in the series, they haven't done that yet. So Al just pops out of nowhere. Yeah.
Didn't know who he was thrilled with his metallic accents. Okay. For the time. I loved the casual cigar smoking. I liked that he was like central casting. Like, I'm going to tell you, my third wife. Like, he was so schmacky, but it seemed also genuine in a way, which I loved.
Yes.
And I also, what is the device called that helps?
Oh, the hand link. Yeah.
The hand link for, like, it looks like an iPhone. So I was like, oh, nothing can see. Oh, wait! This was before that existed.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah,
which he has a great moment with it, actually, where when he starts talking about what year it is, and he's like, year 5,000, and he's oh, Ziggy's doing it Jewish calendar.
Yeah. He's using an iPhone that's being throttled because it's time to upgrade.
Oh, Lord. Yeah.
Anyway.
Although they'll replace your batteries for a lower cost.
Oh, my gosh. But yeah, no, loved him. Didn't, like, know who he was, but didn't need to. Like, got the gist of, like, oh, he's, like, the guy, you know, like, he's the his little companion kind of thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sending him off on places, but he was great. He's great.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just curious, because I realized, like, at this point in the series, like so the opening narration, they don't set up who Al is.
Didn't know who he was. Still don't really know who he is, but was thrilled to have him.
Okay. That's awesome.
I understand his function in the show.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't care. You know, I mean, I do care. Like, at some point, I'm sure I'll get his backstory and stuff, but I was like, at this point, I understand why you're here, and I like your tie, and I'm good to go.
Fantastic.
You know, that makes total sense. It's so interesting hearing it that way, because, you know, it's just a given for us, obviously.
Yeah.
I haven't watched the show so much, but yeah, it's like, you're right. It's like, he serves his purpose, so the rest of it doesn't matter as much.
No.
Yeah. And it was interesting, because there was one line that drops out, I think it is in this first scene, where he's like, ogling all of the food, and he's like, I wish a hologram could eat. And it, not just this line, but there are other lines in other episodes where the writing insinuates that he's not a real person.
Right.
Mm.
But the fact is, like, he is a real person
standing
in a room in the future that's being projected back into the past.
Yeah.
But sometimes even his own dialogue suggests he's not a real flesh and blood person.
Yeah, because I was getting more...
He's just not a flesh and blood person...
In that time.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, that's fascinating, because now all of a sudden I'm thinking about, like, the alternate quantum leap where, like, the Al hologram is, like, an AI. Like, it's not a real person. Like, I hope that never happens, but...
Right. Yeah.
But it is interesting to kind of think that what if somebody did watch it and they didn't realize that it was a human being
for
in the future?
I didn't.
Yeah.
Right. I was getting more, like, Guardian Angel type vibe, which is
okay.
my whole vibe of the show, too, is just, like... Doctor Who with Touched by an Angel and the same.
Yes, we've called it Sci-Fi Touched by an Angel, Sci-Fi
like,
Highway to Heaven.
Della Reese and the TARDIS. Like,
that's awesome.
That
is awesome.
Because I have watched it with other people before who think, like, Al is a ghost.
Yeah.
Or something along that line.
Sure.
And more to your point of talking about, like, in any future iteration of the show, if Al is just some kind of AI.
Oh.
So there's a fan-made movie that was made back in 2009 called A Leap to Die For.
Oh, boy.
Where he leaps into where he thinks he's trying to prevent Princess Diana's death. But one of the sub-stories of this fan-made movie is that they have mothballed the project, and so Al is AI. So there's this one scene where Sam is talking to Al, but Al is just giving like very basic rudimentary information, and Al crashes, and Al crashing literally just like in midair pops up like a Windows crashing screen.
Oh, Lord.
Anyway.
Oh, God.
So let's dive into the meat of the episode here.
Yeah, so you know, the interesting thing is that some of the little details that we get, again, there's some sort of friction here, some sort of issue, you know, even in the marriage. You know, Joe does not want to dance, for instance. Mm-hmm. We meet creepy Bob Ross sexual predator.
Burt, yes.
Yeah.
Russ Tamblyn. Burt Glassinger, yes.
Funny story there, Russ Tamblyn and Dean Stockwell, who plays Al, in real life, were really good friends, very close friends.
Oh, that's Amber Tamblyn's dad, right?
Sure is. In fact, there was a time when Dean Stockwell, Russ Tamblyn, and Dennis Hopper and Neil Young all used to hang out together. They were like four, like they were just super tight. They were like the something Canyon crew, Yellow Canyon crew or something like that. They actually even had a name, and they spent like a good portion of like the late 60s, you know, early mid 70s just, you know, hanging out, forming this friendship. And and Amber Tamblyn, actually, it's funny because she did a podcast with Marc Maron not too long ago, and she talks a lot about how they were basically like all her like godfathers. Like her godfathers were like Dennis Hopper and Neil Young and Dean Stockwell, and it's like, oh my God.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, Russ Tamblyn, good friends with him. And, you know, Russ Tamblyn is actually, you know, not at all, luckily, like Burt Glasserman, because Burt Glasserman
is,
But, like, I love you call him, like, a creepy bald Bob Ross.
Yeah.
That jumped out. I mean, of course, Betsy and I, my wife, like, we've been watching more episodes of Bob Ross on Netflix, because you can actually watch those. Like, we just need to mellow out. Like last night, for example, we watched an episode of Black Mirror, which, if you haven't seen that...
No, I can't.
It is just a really dark show. And this one that we watched last night was an especially, like, cringeworthy, just really dark episode. And so, like, afterwards, like we just need a palate cleanser. So we turned on Bob... I wasn't even trying. You know, the dad jokes come built in. So we were watching some Bob Ross. I love watching Bob Ross with my wife, because at least once an episode, Bob will do something and she'll be like, "You fucked it up! Now fix it!"
He does.
And he's just so nice about it. Oh, that's just a happy mistake.
Yeah. Well, you know. So to bring around a creepy, have you seen the meme on that goes around on Facebook? It's like, you know, Bob Ross, and the question is, what if Bob Ross was a serial killer and he was painting all the places he hid the bodies?
Oh, no, don't do that. Oh, don't do that. Especially like now that we're like all of our childhood heroes turning out to be creepy.
Don't
even bring that on Bob. We need him.
We do. We need somebody.
Because now it doesn't shock me.
Yeah, right? It's like if the report came out that was true, I'd be like
well, yep,
you know, there's another one. To that point, like, more tangent. So it was about a month ago, Jim Nabors passed away, the actor who played
Gomer Pyle.
Mm-hmm. And, like, when I saw the headline on my trending news feed, I just saw Jim Nabors, known as Gomer Pyle.
And you're like, oh, God.
... And you had to click on it to see what happened.
And it said,
I had the thought, please be dead and not a sexual predator.
Yeah.
And he had passed away.
Yeah. He and his husband, actually, though, had been married for, like, a really long time.
Oh, God,
time.
Yeah.
Like he was, you know, the funny thing is he was kind of out at a time when nobody was really out. And he got, and he and his partner, you know, ended up getting married at a time when, well, I guess technically the government would have recognized them as being married, but they recognized themselves as being married, like, long time.
Well,
like 30, 40 years or something crazy like that.
So, creepy Bob Ross.
Yes.
Burt Glasserman.
You get a scene where some of the female guests are discussing, like...
The Quantum Link Piccadilly Ladies?
Yeah.
It's like Jewish Piccadilly Ladies. Like a little oh, and he's, and it's like every church has them, every synagogue has, like, it's always like, oh, and you see, and there's one of them is like the slutty one. Right. And they're oh, and it's like, oh, I went out with him, and it's just, I don't know why I did that accent. I don't know that that's the accent that they use, but
that's
it feels
fine. Yeah,
right.
It's a good joke. Right. Yeah.
Oh, went out. It's such a shame. Oh, and that family, they're all gossiping.
Yeah, yeah, and that's where you find out that that Bert apparently is a widower, and like, his wife has died. But you also get the sense that maybe like he's been, you know, visiting other women, if you will.
Well,
like,
especially, you know. I can't remember her name, but
unfortunately, I can't think of her name right now either.
The, like, central casting, like, slutty one?
The shorthand slutty one. But it's interesting, like, watching the episode, like, when Sam sits down at the table with her, like, the other ladies...
Yeah.
Like they do a weird, like they're not just leaving because it's time to move on. No. Like they're leaving to leave them alone. Which at first like made me think like is
she trying to bang the rabbi?
Well, my first thought was like is David the character that Sam leaped into? Is he kind of the ladies?
Right?
Is that what they were expecting?
Yeah.
But now that I think about it, it's like were the ladies leaving because they thought that she was going to start playing her moves on?
I think so. I mean, I don't know. But those ladies were a real treat.
Well, and we also get the info from Al that, you know, Sam is here to stop Irene, the wife, from having a one-night stand. And Al has lied about, like, well, what's so bad about having a good old-fashioned one-night stand?
Yeah.
I also love that throughout the episode, I don't think they ever said sex.
Oh.
Like, they kept saying, like, one-night stand, or, like...
The affair.
They would call it an affair, or... there's, like... Actually, I'm jumping a little bit ahead, but Al is talking to him about... they have, like, a really poignant discussion about fidelity and, like, if monogamy is... like, it's a very ahead-of-its-time talk about, like, is monogamy the default answer, and is it right for everyone, and blah, blah, blah. And he calls it socializing. He's like, you know, men, they need to socialize. And when you gotta socialize, like, the whole episode, they kept thinking of every way that they could not say the word sex.
It's funny because, like, they're not squeamish about saying that word in another episode.
Swear they didn't say, I mean, they might have said it once or twice, but they kept calling it affair, a one-night stand. And we all know it, like, adults know what they're talking about, but.
Yeah.
Well, even, actually, though, it is funny, because now that you're mentioning this, Kathleen, there is an episode earlier on in the season where Al has the more famous lines of, you know, I have loved every woman I've ever slept with. But he says...
At the time I slept with them.
But he specifically says slept with, as opposed to, I've loved all the women I've had sex with.
Yeah.
You know, and so, like... But you're right, they're not squeamish usually about using...
Yeah.
No. But it is interesting that you're right, in this episode, it's not like... It's like she has sex with somebody else. It's
my
like,
mom
no.
used to hate... She didn't want me watching Friends, because she would say... They're just always hopping into bed with each other. Just hopping into bed. So she calls it hopping into bed.
Of course. Yes. Yes. It's funny because my grandmother, who is in her early 90s now, she never had any problems say the word, like, sex. Like, because she had similar opinions on the show.
Yeah.
But she would have just been like, I just don't like all the sex. There's just, it's like... Hey, Grandma, you know?
Yeah.
She tried to have, like, one of the talks with me one time on a plane.
Oh, boy.
I was, like, 10 years old.
Because you can't move.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Why, that's
like,
do it.
You're a captain.
I've heard of parents being like, I took the kids, and I put them in the car, and we drove to a faraway Costco for me to buy them condoms, and I had the talk there because they couldn't move.
Wow.
They were strapped in.
Wow. All right. I know, right? It's like some sort of weird, like... interrogation technique from the the CIA.
It's also good, though, too, because you don't have to look them in the eye.
Right,
because
you're driving.
Yeah.
Mm.
So you get to have the talk, but you don't have to have uncomfortable looks.
Yeah.
So when...
And unless they want to tuck and roll.
Yeah.
Well, I can remember distinctly being on this airplane, and it wasn't like she wasn't like whispering.
Yeah.
Like, other people could probably hear, her talking to me and asking me about sex. Yeah, I know. It's like, Grandma.
And chime in.
The thing is at the time, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily call myself precocious, but I was definitely not, I wasn't too embarrassed by it either, you know? I'd just done, like, my first, like, sex ed classes in school or whatever, so I was like, oh, yeah, I know, that's cool, I'm good.
Yeah. I lived in a household. I grew up and we lived in a very tiny trailer.
Yeah.
And my dad watched whatever the hell he wanted to, and he didn't care. So my sex talk was basically like at the age of 4 or 5, by way of Porky's, way of Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Oh my god!
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
But you know, because I have an 11-month-old son, like, even, like, thinking ahead, like, how... Yeah, like, yeah. Like how do we have that talk, but I also want to, like...
13 more years.
Yeah.
Go to the DeKalb Costco.
I mean, no kid is comfortable with talking with their parents about that kind of stuff, but I, like, how to even, like, set up, like, from a young age to, like, like, set things up to where, like...
Right.
To where your children, you know, where my son is always going to know, like, if he needs to come talk to me about that kind of stuff, then...
Yeah, the dialogue.
Yeah, it happens before you go to DeKalb, for sure.
Right. Yeah.
Set it up before that trip.
Yeah.
just walk in and, you know.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway. It's $10.
Yeah.
Oh, so that was another thing I liked is how, like you were saying about something, how all the exposition takes place really succinctly.
Mm-hmm.
And firstly, it goes, better get gas before... Oh, the gas shortage.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, here is the year that we're in.
Right.
Everyone, you'll remember this. And then when they're in the car waiting for gas, he goes, first time in 22 years I'm thinking about having an affair. It's like, that's all the information you need to know in one sentence.
Yes.
Yeah,
we've set it up.
We know how long you're married. You know, like.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and let's see. Because we skipped over just a couple of things that I want to go back to
real
quick. No,
We leap all over the place.
Yeah.
Yes.
So a moment back during the reception is that they even very clearly set up, because there's like a very direct shot of showing Bert purposefully stepping on Irene's foot while they're dancing.
Yeah.
And I was like, they're already...
Yeah.
Setting up.
Well, and so there's this nice moment just in general, because Irene is super happy that Karen is dancing with Michael Kornblum.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's a name. Like, so she's super excited about that. She tries to tell Joe about it. Joe's, like, not really interested about it.
Yeah.
Joe ends up, what does he say? Does he say something about Danny there?
Not yet.
No, there's a scene later on at home.
Okay.
Right.
So she wants to dance with Joe, and Joe's just like, I don't want to dance. And then Bert swoops in, and Bert's like, I'll dance with you, you know.
Yeah.
So they go off to dance. And even Sam was like, you should have danced with her. And Joe gets kind of shitty and is like... Is that advice from my brother or from my rabbi?
Because I don't need it for mine.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
So yeah, the tension is there. But then we get back to the house, and he's got to go get the gas because of the gas shortage.
Yeah, yeah. But even there, like, we have a nice scene of the daughter Karen, like, opening up gifts, and the Tony Orlando and Dawn
8-track.
And why in the world does Sam say you're going to get a lot of use out of this? I can't imagine Sam would listen to Tony Orlando. But for whatever reason, Sam's like, you're going to get a lot of use out of
this.
And the puka shell necklace.
Well, you know, at least he's evolved from a few episodes ago of, like, looking at the 8-track tape and talking about how outdated and old they are, and the other character looking at him going,
uh-huh.
I just
this is
bought
brand
it.
New.
Yeah.
Just came out.
He's learning the ropes of this.
So, yeah.
You know?
They also set up the disconnect between the daughter and the dad.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's really nicely done, because Sam says a thing about, like, I think this boy really likes you, and then she's like, she's excited, so she wants, you know, dad to know, and it's like, look what Michael Kornblum got me, and that's the moment when he's like, you know, Danny used to
hang out with Michael Kornblum's older brother.
Yeah, he used to come over. In fact, I don't even think he says, he doesn't say Danny's name, does he?
He just says, his older brother Bobby used to come over. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But yeah,
they still don't drop it yet.
They talk around it,
yeah.
And then he says, she says, he's at Yale now. And it's like, oh yeah, that's right, he went to Yale. You know?
He went to Yale too.
Yeah.
That was the thing that kind of drops that there was...
That there is or was another kid.
And that's another thing that's great about this episode, is that, like, and we haven't even talked about it too much. I mean, I've kind of sort of the bees by mentioning his name multiple times, but there's a missing piece here that we're not getting, and it's just really it makes you invest a little bit more, because you're like, there's something else. Yeah. And even though, again, this is like my fourth, fifth, whatever time watching the episode, even then I was still able to really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. You know, but then they go to the gas station and then there's the affair line, and that's like kind of like this moment of just like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Like, he's here to stop Irene from having an affair, but Joe's the one that's talking about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's an interesting moment.
Mm-hmm.
And to jump back, I think it's interesting how Al even sets it up in that first scene of you're here to stop her from having a one-night stand and ruining their marriage.
Right.
Like, it's already been clearly set up from the beginning that Joe's kind of a dick. We don't know why yet, but Joe's kind of a dick.
Yeah.
But the blame is already being put on the wife being the one who has the affair and ruins the marriage.
Well, and the thing is he's talking, you know, he even in the car before he gets to drop in that line, too, he's talking about how, you know, father and son go into the basketball game and, like, all this sort of stuff. And he's talking about, like, what he and David used to do with their father. But there's clearly more to it. And then, yeah, when we get the sort of the lamentation about having an affair, the next thing we see is Al kind of advocating for it. Like, maybe he needs to just get it out of his system. They should both just go do it, get it out of their system.
I love, like, he throws out, maybe you're here to let them have affairs, but make sure that the other one doesn't find out.
Right.
I feel like the sort of, like, don't ask, don't tell polyamory is, like, not unheard of nowadays. It's still, like, salacious in a way to, like, mainstream culture. And that's why I thought was so forward of them, is to be like, oh, maybe monogamy isn't the only, you know?
It's not the be-all end all,
I think on one hand it's progressive, but on the other hand, like Al says in line, like, if men were allowed to socialize with everyone, there would be no wars. And then Sam says, until the wives found out, and then Al says, I agree. As progressive as it is, like, both Sam and especially Al are making the assumption that men should be able to sleep around.
Yeah, but women.
But not necessarily talk about it, be open about it, not allowing for the possibility that you can have a non-monogamous relationship, and you're just both honest with each other about it.
Right, well, and it is interesting, too, though, that, you know, he doesn't say, because I feel like it is not something out of the question for Al to say that if he had basically just been like, oh yeah, Joe should sleep around but not mention Irene. The fact that he says that they should both have affairs, you know, have the one idea to get it out of their system, that's kind of, I mean, within the context of the TV show, that seems kind of progressive for Al.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Especially when they're still calling it socializing.
Right. Yes.
But it's also
socialize,
like,
yeah.
All right. But it is bookended with the, you know, very 80s joke of, well, until the wives find out.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and
those nags.
I think that the episode, for whatever reason, still gets elevated above certain episodes where we've had, where those buttons do take away from it.
Yeah.
That just really
felt like two guys talking about it.
Yeah. It worked. But one thing to go back just real quick to kind of talk about the relationship between Joe and his daughter is that when he goes to get gas, she actually asked to go with him.
And he's like,
no.
Like, why would you want to come with
him? Why would you want to come with me? And then, you know, has Sam go with him instead. And the reason I bring that up is because, like, one of the next things that we see is Sam sitting down playing Scrabble with her.
Yeah.
And you get the sense already from the very first shot where we see her kind of looking at Joe to at the dance to, you know, afterwards opening presents to right now that, like, she clearly is not getting something that she needs.
Yeah.
And I think the predictable thing for this episode would have been to focus purely on Irene not getting what she needs, and so she's going to have an affair.
Yeah.
And instead, we're seeing a young girl where, you know, she's not getting what she needs either and is trying to have it fulfilled in other ways, whether that's playing Scrabble with her uncle or, you know, talking about her presence. Dancing with Michael Cornblum. Exactly. And so I think that that was a really smart thing to do because it really, it broadened the episode up a bit and gave it a little bit more weight.
Totally.
And of course we get the comedic moment where Sam plays sushi as a Scrabble word. She's like, that's not a word.
That is a word. You know, I looked that up. Yeah.
It is a word. And like,
it is.
I can understand the thing of, like, oh, people just, like, it, maybe it wasn't a trend then. But, like, sushi existed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I looked up, trying to find the origin of the word sushi, and I couldn't find that. But I actually found that it's a misnomer. Sushi does not mean raw fish. Sushi is actually an old Japanese term that means gone sour.
Huh. Wow.
Well, great.
Well,
that explains so much.
The more you know. But relevant to the plot in this scene is Karen asking David, like, do you ever think about the getting married one day? You know, like, things like, you know, I'm going to marry someone cute. I'm going to marry someone this. And this is the melodramatic moment. I'm going to marry someone who doesn't yell.
Yes. Yeah. That was a little bit after.
That was a bit. Yeah.
Right. Well, and then immediately after that, we get Sam picking up the guitar
playing
and and she's like that's Danny's guitar, and she clears the board immediately and like puts everything away and
which also like going from the like thinking that he is the actual uncle, what a dick move to pick up your dead nephew's guitar.
Well, that's the other thing too that's so great about it, because at this moment we still don't know. Yeah, we have no idea who Danny is.
Yeah,
we're like, I think obviously it's
seeping out.
Right, but they haven't explicitly stated it yet, and I'm kudos. Good for you.
Then they do it.
This is where they drop the Danny thing. But you know, like the weird thing, the weird moment, like a little personal story about. My dad passed away several years ago, and so it was a thing of the last couple weeks, like there was something going on, we were sick, we weren't sure what was going on, and usually like when he napped, he just napped on the living room couch,
mm-hmm.
but so the last time that he was in the house before the ambulance took him to the hospital, he decided to go back and in the bedroom that we had in the trailer, like there were a set of bunk beds, and for whatever reason, instead of sleeping in the bottom bunk, my dad pulled himself up onto the top bunk.
Wow.
And then eventually, like things got worse. The ambulance came. They took him to the hospital a couple weeks later.
Yeah.
Things took a turn for the south. Whatever. A couple years later. I was home visiting, and by that point, the bunk beds had been moved out of one family member's house into another family's house. We're getting ready to go to bed, and not even thinking, like, I just walked into the bedroom, and I threw myself up on the top bunk, because, like, that's where I'm going to sleep.
Yeah.
And I can't remember, it was one of my sisters, like, they were in the room, and I just threw myself up on the top bunk, and they were just like...
What? Yeah.
They just got really weird, and then they just walked out of the room.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And then in the discussion that we had later, it was like... Yeah, I was the first person who had gotten up in the top bunk.
Wow!
Since my dad passed away, so it was just like weird, like you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like I would have never have thought like that would have set something off. You never know.
But at least it was your own dad. It's not just like
I'm
a stranger in your house.
Yeah,
so let me just play.
Yeah.
But so they're at the dinner. Then we find out that. They had lost the son. Oh, no, maybe not explicitly. Oh, no, because they talk about the funeral.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because Karen is being somewhat distant, and Samantha is like, I think I upset her because I played Danny's guitar.
Right.
Not figuring out who Danny is, and that's when we figure out, like, they need to set the headstone, and Irene starts pushing the conversation.
Right.
It's been a year. Yeah.
It's been a year. Which, you know, it's been a year, but it's only been a year.
Well, right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so Joe yells, Karen gets upset, she leaves the table, and that's why, by way of melodramatic voiceover, Sam figures out that the family is coping with the loss of...
Here's a question that leads me to the next thing. Does he always need to figure out where to stay for the night? Because he said, and I was like, he would know where the rabbi's house is. But, like, I was like, is this a recurring thing in the show where it's like...
No. That's a great question. That's interesting because usually, like, they never show it. But, like, you just assume that he's resourceful enough that he can pull out his wallet, look at his address,
and figure
out how to get home. But it is weird.
Well, because then this episode, he's like, I'll be. So then they're up in Danny's room.
Yeah.
He's going to sleep in the dead son's bed?
Yeah. We're just breaking all these norms. Just like,
right.
Bing, bang, boom.
It's like, you got that upset about the guitar, but you're about to lay this man in your son's bedroom?
But also I think we're gonna find this later on, like Irene is at the point like
I'm ready,
she's ready, someone should be playing Danny's guitar, someone should be sleeping in the room.
Right.
My other favorite thing was she asked him if he wanted a soft or a hard pillow. I can understand maybe having a pillow preference. I've never thought about it. I'm just a pillow, thank you.
Right, exactly.
And I'm like, can I get a hot pillow, please? Extra starch.
You know what I've just realized is that, you know, most normal people don't. I've always felt like less of a person because when I do have a guest stay at the house, I can't offer them a soft or a hard pillow.
I
think it comes back to this episode.
Well, because then, so I thought the question was super weird. But then they like have that tense moment of almost kissing, and he's like, "Oh," blah, blah. And then like they lean in and almost kiss, and then she says it again, like, "So that was a hard pillow. Oh, that's why they set that up. But I was like, what sloppy, terrible joke writing for you to talk about, like, dicks through a pillow? Like,
Dicks Through a Pillow, our new podcast.
Yeah. The Fate Wide Wheel podcast.
But also, so then that was the other thing. It was like, I was appalled that, like, he was going to sleep in the bed. And then it was like, you know, they stopped themselves from kissing, but it's like, were you guys about to smash on your dead son's bed?
And it's weird because, like, Sam almost initiates that. Because it's like hands on the shoulder, but then his hands, like, reach up to her face. And
It is interesting. I don't know. It's a moment. It's a moment.
It's a moment.
I think just sort of the melodrama of it all. I think that there is this element, too, where Sam is definitely not Team Joe right now, you know? Yeah. I think that he's sort of like, God, I get what's happening here, and I even though he's clearly very against the idea of any kind of infidelity, you know, Sam clearly is Mr. Monogamy in his own mind, but I think that I don't know. It's somewhat predictable. It helps to further along the plot. But I think it still kind of works to just add to that melodramatic tension that we're getting anyway. Especially because then, you know, Sam has this moment alone where it's like, it's me. I'm the one.
Yeah.
Because at this point, it's not been established who she sleeps with.
Who's the
affair is
gonna
be. Yeah. Yeah.
And we don't know if it's going to be the dad or if it's the parent, you know.
Well, and then there's this very funny moment, actually, between him and Al, where Al is like, well, if it's you, if you're the one she sleeps with, all you have to do is do nothing, and then you'll be fine.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they just kind of stand there.
Yeah, and he kind of points out, promise. Promise him that you won't have an affair.
Yeah.
I promise.
And then they just kind of stand there for a second, like, waiting, and then nothing happens.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like, well, guess that's not going to work.
No.
And the bake sale is now happening, and, like, you know, Karen is helping.
Cut back to the rec room.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like, you paid for this set?
Yeah. We're going to milk
it
for all
its... We're going to use it twice.
Damn right.
We're going to milk it for all it's worth.
And, you know...
They bring up Canisius again.
Yep.
They do indeed,
Because they're like, okay.
So I can't remember in what order, if Bert shows up and talks to Irene again, or Sam talks to Karen
first. Oh, he sure does, with his pipe.
Yes.
Which now his pipe means,
pipe.
Like, a credit, because it's... Magnificent.
Which there's something I want to talk about later on that has to do with the pipe, which is just hilarious to me. But in this particular moment, he's just kind of.
I know what
pipe.
You're talking about.
Yeah.
Yes.
I
yeah.
figured you would.
Yeah.
But so he comes over and he starts talking, and once again he brings up his wife and he's talking about going through his grief, and then we find out that he's writing this book and that.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, it just now occurred to me. I should talk to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'd be perfect to interview for my book. And she doesn't want to. In fact, she pretty much shuts him down. Like, no.
Yeah.
And then he starts talking about, no, it's therapeutic, it's good. And again, Bert is just like, every time, just laying it on thick. Like, Bert is just, like, there is no doubt, and I'm not saying that this is anyone's fault or that this is even a bad thing, but there is no doubt that Bert wants something.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh,
like, and it's not just to talk about grief.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just so interesting the way that he comes off, because it's like why is anybody buy into this crap?
Because I just think he was so creepy in the first scene. Like, it's not as slathered on in the first scene, except for, like, his turtleneck. But, except for his turtleneck blazer combo, that's the only thing that would elude. But in this scene, he comes in smoking a pipe indoors and being like, I just want to feel your grief. You know, like, he really...
Yes.
This time, it's like, oh, no. Now, you know, this has been revealed that he's a creep.
Like, it's not David. It's got to be this dude, you know.
Yeah.
Which, even early on, like, again, I agree with you. In the first scene where he's around, you don't get the sense necessarily that it's like, oh, this is the guy.
Yeah.
It's just more like, oh, that's just a guy, you know, at the temple.
It's,
you know,
it's someone in the cast of players, but you're not, like, 100% sure.
Mm. Right, right.
But then, so then we get our slutty Piccadilly back, which, I mean, slutty in a sex-positive way.
Yeah.
But
okay.
But, she comes back.
God, she didn't even get a name. Even on, like, Quantum Leap Wiki,
she's not there.
Just referred to as the woman.
The woman. Yeah. Oh, okay, all right. So, before that, do we get, Sam has another conversation with Karen. So we have that moment where there's the
that happens after the conversation with
The woman.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So so they go outside with the woman because they're going to have that meeting, and this is where the woman reveals that she had an affair with Bert. And I want Sam to be smarter, and I want him to figure it out, like, right now.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
oh,
right,
Bert is the guy.
Shirley, actually. Her character did have a name, according to IMDb, as Shirley.
Okay.
For what it's worth.
Okay. So Shirley, you know, says that after... who was it in her life that passed away that the husband didn't under...
Oh, yeah.
It was someone in her life that had passed away, and her husband didn't understand, and Bert was understanding, and so that's how...
Death of her father.
Death of her father.
Yeah, and he was saying all the right things. And,
And what I don't think this has ever happened before in Quantum Leap, but I just realized, like, watching this episode for the first time, that scene ends with Sam going, because Shirley asks, what should I do?
Yeah.
And Sam goes... I think we should set up another meeting. Okay. And I realize Sam is passing the buck to David after David leaps back in.
It's like, I don't know what to do.
I don't have the skill set for this.
Not my expertise.
Can we meet about 5 minutes after I leap out?
Right, exactly. So I don't have to. And it's funny because she's even like, another appointment. Like, what do you mean? Are you going to try to sleep with me too?
The first time?
We need to set up another appointment. My house.
Sam passing the buck.
But then, then we get the scene where Irene's packing up and Sam comes in and they start talking and, you know, he's trying to be supportive, trying to figure things out. And they even have this moment where they kind of sort of address what happened the night before. And the great thing is, and this is something that I really liked, is that they both basically, like, Sam doesn't have to work to, like, shut anything down.
Yeah.
Like, even Irene is just sort of like, you know.
I want to thank you for, the subtext is, please, let's never talk about what almost happened.
Right. Like, there's not this, like, there's not, like, this moment all of a sudden where you're thinking, like, oh, Irene wants their brother-in-law.
No.
Like, it's not that at all.
No, it was just, like, weird, like, they'd all purged all these emotions at dinner and all this stuff was happening. And, like, it makes you do weird stuff.
We didn't talk about it explicitly, but that's one of the things. Like, she has just had this emotional moment where she talked about, like, feeling like it's her fault that the son died.
Oh, yeah,
because he wanted to go backpacking in Europe, and she had to, like, basically convince Joe that it was right to let him go, and they let him go, and then he dies in a plane crash.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's just sort of like, and I had a couple of thoughts about that. The one thought that I had is like, this couldn't have been, like, a commercial, like, airline disaster, because if it was, like, there would have been other people kind of in the same boat with them grieving. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not saying that they would have done this, like, grief circle or whatever or anything like that, but at the same time, you just get the, like, I got the sense that it had to be... Yeah, that it had to be, like, maybe they got to Europe, they had to charter, like, a special plane to get to the mountains or something like that. I don't know. It just didn't seem to me that this was, like, some sort of commercial, like, airline disaster that Danny died on, because I felt like that would have had to have been talked about a little bit, maybe. Mm. I don't know.
But the way I wrote this down, because it shocked me to my core, because the way they finally actually said, we find out how he dies, is he goes, when she's talking about, I was, like, encouraging him to go to Europe, and the dad didn't want. And then Sam goes, and he loved you for that.
Yeah.
And then she responds, do you think he loved me when the plane crashed?
Yeah.
Damn!
Yeah.
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 Yes, yeah. How do we miss
that? Like,
I know. Yeah. Well, she's remembering, like, his laugh.
Yeah.
And she's, you know, so it's a very emotional
moment. That's, like, another, like... super succinct exposition. It's like you get so much from that one line of, do you think he loved me when the plane crashed?
Yeah, right.
We get how he died, we get the feelings behind it. It was like, oh,
she's got this massive guilt over it all. And it's interesting because one of the things that I've been thinking about, and hey, you know, Kathleen, I know this is something that you wouldn't be aware of, but one of the things that I couldn't help but think about a lot during this episode, thought about a little bit during Jimmy too, which we'll talk about next week, but that said, is this is something that's got to be kind of close to Sam's heart. You know what I mean? Like, thinking about, especially with Karen, like, here's this little girl who's lost her big brother.
Yeah.
You know? And I don't know if it ever gets really explicitly stated in the episode or that Sam even displays anything specifically, but we already know that his brother died. Like, his older brother died. Like, that's something we learned in one of the first episodes of the season.
So, one of the first episodes of the season, like, because Sam has partial amnesia, which they don't really explain in this episode.
No.
Sam doesn't remember a lot of the future, especially about the own personal details of his own life.
Sure.
So, just a few episodes ago, he finally remembered that he had an older brother, and once he figures that out, Al fills him in and says, his older brother got killed in Vietnam.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's just interesting thinking about Sam kind of like helping this family grieve when it's something that Sam would be close to his own heart. And Sam even has a line in the episode about what it would be like to go home, to go back home to be, you know, to be home, to basically to be around his family and stuff. And, you know, just perhaps foreshadowing.
For sure.
I don't know. There's just something kind of interesting about that, thinking about, like, Sam, you know, whether or not he remembers that or not, but just in the context of us knowing it, that it's interesting to see him now helping these people through their grief. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he finally suggests to Irene in this later scene, after they've kind of had their, like, you know, it's okay, everything's fine, let's never talk about it again, is that she should go away with Joe for the weekend.
Yeah.
Like, just
the
two of them. Go to the beach house. Go away. I'll watch Karen. You know, we'll hang out and play Scrabble, and she'll tell me sushi's not a real word again. You know, whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, go do this. This will be really great. And Irene, like, lights up the thought of this. Mm-hmm. She's just like, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Like, just the two of us going out and being away. Like, I would love that.
Yeah. This is a factoid that I heard before, and, like, watching this episode, I looked it up again and saw that I don't know how they track these things, but there's a statistic out there that 80% of marriages when they lose a child, 80% of marriages end in divorce.
Yeah.
And one article I was reading, like, a lot of it is like, a lot of that can be caused by the fact, like, the man feels like he has to be, like, strong and can't express emotions and can't do anything in that regard.
Fight the patriarchy.
Yeah. nice to provide song.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Skinny. It's better than that. Yeah.
So that was like, it was in my mind, like, watching this episode.
Totally. Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because my my mom died about 16. A little over 16 years ago.
Wow.
My uncle died about a year after that. Oh. So my grandparents, you know, lost both of their kids in the span of about a year or two there. And they had problems. And these were people that are in their, like, you know, 70s and, you know, late 70s, had been married for like 50 years.
Yeah.
And it caused a struggle between the two of them, even at that late stage in their marriage and that late stage, you know, in their own lives. And, I mean, and there are a lot of other things that contributed to it, too. I think also they were, you know, they ended up moving shortly after that out of the home that they lived in for, like, 55 years. So there's a lot of stuff. So, I mean, they had some stuff that they had to even work through.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where it's, like, it's got to be incredibly difficult, even if you're talking. I mean, obviously, if you lose, you know, child under the age of 18 or whatever, it's going to be different than if you lose an adult child. But it's still, exactly.
Yeah, one of my mom's good friends had a daughter who was severely delayed. Like, she was still in diapers, and she passed away when she was 30. Like, she had all sorts of disabilities. She was in a group home, and her whole life was so hard.
Yeah.
And when she lost her daughter, people didn't react to her in the same way that if you had lost, like, a healthy, active, you know, like, it's, and I think people thought it must have been a relief for,
like,
her.
A mercy or something.
Or, like, because, I mean, this was a 30-something-year-old woman at the ability level of a, you know, she only had, like, 3 or 4 words kind of thing. And she still lost a daughter.
Yeah.
And it's like, the loss of a child, I've heard, is one of, I mean, there isn't anything worse.
Right. No, obviously it was difficult, you know, for them, and I mean, they're doing great now. Grandpa's going to be 98.
Yes, Grandpa!
Tomorrow, yeah, I know. But anyway, I think, that
it can rock you.
It can, and I think that the episode does a really wonderful job of ultimately making this episode more about grief than about Sam stopping an affair.
Yeah.
And I love that.
It's not about the socializing.
Yes.
It's not
the socializing.
Yeah.
You know, that being said, I am going to say, this is the second time in like 5 episodes that they've gone to the dead kid well.
Oh.
Americanization of Machiko.
Oh, right. God, yeah. Oh, I try to block that one from my memory as well.
Yeah. there's a previous episode where about halfway through the episode, Sam figures out that part of the problem of the episode is a parent is having a hard time dealing with a child who has passed away.
Can I see Matt's book real quick?
Sure.
Matt Dale's excellent book called Beyond the Mirror Image, The Observer's Guide to Quantum Leap, which we use here quite a bit. Yes, the dead kid. Well, I can't even speak. I'm Italian, man.
That's all good.
So you've used this theme multiple times.
Well, we've recorded out of order as we do sometimes. We already recorded the Jimmy episode, and I mentioned it at the beginning of the Jimmy episode that I had a fun evening last night. My wife's sister and her boyfriend are in town for the weekend, and they're getting ready to leave for Spain, so they came up to Chicago. And we went out last night, painted the town red, had a really good time. So I'm feeling a little rough around the edges today, just a bit. So anyway, the second time we've gone back to that after Machico, it is definitely handled, I think, better overall here, especially because, again, that it ends up feeling so tacked on in Machico, honestly, in some ways, whereas here it's so integral to the story as a whole. Yeah. It's, you know, again, the episode feels a little bit more about grief itself than about, you know, the leap or whatever, which is nice. So they get home. It's, you know, it's great.
So wait, I want to jump back because we get this moment tacked in. We get a little kiss with history.
Oh, right.
And in the middle of a conversation with Karen, someone starts choking off to the side. Sam walks over.
That's my favorite.
Gives a Heimlich maneuver. And then as they're walking off, the woman goes, "Are you all right, Dr. Heimlich?" Another one of those moments of my wife watching the show with me. She's like, "Oh, she was acting."
Yeah.
And so I was looking stuff up about the Heimlich maneuver after that moment. It's not called the Heimlich maneuver anymore.
No, it's called an abdominal thrust.
Yes.
Or else you have to pay Dr. Heimlich.
From the story that well, maybe that's correct.
That's what I learned in my lifeguarding training. No big deal.
Wow.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Because, like, what I read is basically Dr. Heimlich apparently was not a very nice...
Oh, boy.
Was not a very nice person. Because before he developed this maneuver, just like the standard thing was just like hitting someone in the back between the shoulder blades. And so he started strongly advocating against that. He actually, like banging on someone's back, he actually called them death blows. And he, like, his method of the abdominal thrust was the, quote, only way to save someone from choking. And he really pushed that really hard, and that's why for 20 years, like that was the thing.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I was reading, like, even his own children came out against him and were just saying, like, basically, dude was kind of a dick.
What's that nameless thing about?
And you can still save someone's life by banging on their back.
Oh.
So as of 2006, the suggested way to save someone from choking is to first to try hitting them in the back between the shoulder blades, and then if that doesn't work, doing the abdominal thrust, which what I read, I understood is to say, like, they stopped calling it the Heimlich maneuver. It's basically like taking it away from.
Yeah.
Dr. Heimlich.
Oh, creepy Heimlich.
So, yeah, actually, it's funny here, too, because Roger White, a doctor at the Mayo Clinic and of the American Heart Association, is quoted as saying, "There was never any science here. Heimlich overpowered science all along the way with his slick tactics and intimidation, and everyone, including us at the AHA, caved in." Also funny, Henry Heimlich has apparently, on record, only used the maneuver twice, and the second time was in 2016, saving the life of a fellow resident at his retirement home in Cincinnati.
Well, that's a nice way to bookend your life.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, anyway.
So rewatching that scene, like, I'm seeing Dr. Heimlich walk off, seeing money signs,
I got something.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because apparently he didn't actually publish the report or discover his maneuver, if you will. Eddie Izzard actually has a great little bit about the Heimlich maneuver, and he goes on talking about how much of an egoist you have to be to name a maneuver after
yourself.
Yeah. Anyway, it's interesting because this episode takes place in February of 74. Mm-hmm. The maneuver itself was not talked about or published until August of 74. So the timeline is right.
It works out.
They got
sometimes,
the timeline.
Sometimes they're kisses with history. They fudge a little now and then.
I also feel like we can't leave the scene until we discuss Al's bolo tie.
Oh, wow.
And what I thought was at first the bolo tie, and then I turned around and was like, is that a dicky? Is it just a giant amulet? Whatever it is, I am on board.
Yep.
It is an amazing outfit.
That's the orange one, right? The one where it kind of looks like a Dorito?
I think that's what he wears With the exception of the last scene, I think this is what he wears for the rest of the episode.
Okay, that's what I thought too. Yeah. Because it's the first scene he wears something different, and then the rest of the episode he's in the Dorito outfit, and then he's at the end. Yeah, no, what can I say? But yeah, it is. It is something else. His wardrobe. We've talked about it a number of times. We even talked about it on the Jimmy episode.
Yeah. Which is to say, I mean, this is going to be repeating myself from the Jimmy episode, which listeners won't be hearing until next week.
Right.
But hey, time travel's weird.
Exactly.
The entire reason the logistical reason why they dress Dean Stockwell in those outfits is shorthand for any of you who are tuning in the middle of an episode who's telling you he is not of this time.
Right.
He sticks out.
Right.
Yeah.
He's wearing some loud outfits.
Yeah.
But we get back to the house, and clearly, like, again, Irene is ecstatic about this idea. She's already packed. She's got the bags at the door ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Joe comes home from work. Joe has clearly had a bit of a rough day. I think Joe's days are always pretty rough in general.
Yeah.
Like,
they never establish what he does.
No, they don't.
He's got the briefcase.
He's dressed.
He's
really
got the
nicely,
heavy shoulders.
Suit.
He's got a three-piece suit.
Right.
By the way, I always feel like this annoys you when I bring it up, but I like bringing it up just because I've seen episodes again and again. We're in the house.
Oh, right.
We are in the house that they always use.
It doesn't annoy me.
Hilarious. Like, even though, like, no matter what year they're in or where they jump around, like, they have the apartment sets that they use for, like, Blind Faith, and they use for Disco Inferno. Then they have the house set where they move and they rearrange pieces.
Yeah.
But, like, this is
a house.
Yeah, but this is a house that they used in Starcross. This is a house that they used in How the Test Was Won. They just redressed this one house set. And there we go.
Well, and this is the scene in particular where I was talking about the lighting designer on the show this week earned their paycheck, because this scene is so well lit, and the camera is at this kind of low angle for a lot of the scene, and it's just so beautiful, and it feels like it feels like an old 50s melodrama in a lot of ways. It's got that pink light kind of on it. There's like a lot of Joe is mainly lit in shadow for a lot of this, whereas Irene in the entryway, like in another room, there's a doorway there, is like in, you know, she's more well lit. Sam's kind of in between the two of them for most of it. When Karen eventually comes into the scene, like, it's just a really interesting dynamic, and it's like, man, they were going for art right here.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't just like, we're cranking out a TV show. This was something where it's like,
no,
hey,
sure,
we can do something.
I
really like it, but yeah, Joe of course shoots down the idea right away.
Yeah,
I got too much work to do.
Yeah,
and Irene is like, take it with you, I don't mind.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's doing everything
she is
can.
Trying
like,
so damn
yeah.
hard.
Yeah,
Joe deserves to be cheated on.
Oh. And eventually, of course, she's just like, screw it, I'll go by myself.
Yeah.
Well, even there's the line where we're like, listen to David. Like, David knows what he's talking about.
Right.
Because, like, Sam's trying to convince him. And Joe says, like, well, maybe you should have married her.
And
she's like,
maybe I should have.
Yeah.
And then I wrote, oh, shit.
Yeah.
And then the daughter comes out, because it's like when everything bubbles over. And then the daughter comes out, something about, and they're talking about Danny, and goes, I wish it was me.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, this is, like, the soapiest of dialogue, but these actors made it really...
They made it,
yeah.
It
even
was so...
Girl.
Yeah, it was like, that's the most... That is how I would write a soap opera, with, like, maybe I should have.
Right.
It was real.
Yeah.
And it's funny, so recently I love the Criterion Collection, they produce really high quality, like, DVDs and Blu-rays, and they always do a couple of sales a year, like 50% off, and because they're high quality, they usually cost a little more, so I pretty much only buy them on the sales.
Yeah.
There's this Douglas Sirk film called All That Heaven Allows, and there's times within this episode that kind of just reminded me of, you know, the dialogue, or even that shot that I mentioned about that. And again, I don't know that there's any correlation between the two whatsoever, but it just was something that kind of made me think of that. And that's one of the things that's fascinating about that movie, is some of the dialogue. It's like, that is soap opera 101, like, without a doubt. But most of the time, it isn't playing off really well, because they've got great actors saying these lines. And here's a great example of that. It's like, you know, everybody's just working really well together and doing a good job, and... It's, you know, again, it's the same thing. We'll talk about this in Jimmy as well. They really were just getting lucky with the scripts and the casting, I feel like, right about now. I mean, not even luck. I mean, there's got to be some skill to it as well. But it just, we're in the sweet spot of season two, without a doubt. And they did a string of episodes that are just on point, and this is one of them.
Mm.
Yeah.
But the daughter, I mean, she's having this moment. She's so upset. Sam's comforting her.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, they share a really nice moment together. you know, and you could tell, like, again, like I was saying earlier, things are still going to be kind of hard for her.
Yeah.
This isn't like we're putting a bow on it, but
no.
But he makes her feel better,
yeah.
You know?
Right.
He is earning his keep.
Right.
Yeah. And then he gets directions to the beach house.
Sure.
And he takes off to go to the beach house. Of course, this is when we find out that Bert is going to be there with her.
Mm-hmm.
And Al tells
him
that he's a fraud. Like, he looks on his iPad and says...
this is where he...
He looks on his iPhone and says, oh, Bert.
Yeah, he wrote, he wrote this book.
Bestseller.
Women in Pain. Al read this. It's chapter 6.
Irene is chapter 6.
Yeah, Irene is chapter 6, yeah.
The best part about this, though, is, and the thing that I feel like even on repeat viewings, it doesn't always pop into my head like, oh, right. This is where we find out Bert was never even married.
Yeah.
There's no dead wife.
There is no dead wife.
He's made this story up so that he can, you know, get with these women so that he can use their stories for his book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So now Bert has gone from being slightly creepy
to
like sexual predator.
Yeah.
Right. That I wonder, like, hearing Al's line that he read the book, like, did he read the book, like, back then?
Yeah.
Or when it finally, like, came up, like, in Ziggy's database, like, he's like, oh, I'm gonna read this really quick.
Yeah, I think he actually says there's something in the dialogue that establishes that he, like, just read it.
Yeah.
Like, that he literally just read this. Like, it's not something that he picked up in the 70s to pick up women or whatever, you know, but...
I would not put that
No, I wouldn't put it past Al either,
I was
but,
the,
yeah.
It's fine.
I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
So how did Bert show up at the... Did she call him?
I think it was established at some point earlier in the episode that he had a beach house out there.
Oh, okay.
As well. Yeah, because it's a conversation that Bert and Joe
had in
one of the very first scenes. Like, I never see you out at the beach house.
Oh,
and Joe's
we
bought a second house. We never go out there.
Sure.
But the moment... And this is one of those things where, again, just like being interested in sort of... film art in general, my brain kind of kicked in, is the only thing that separates Bert's appearance from around the corner seeing Irene going into the beach house from this being like a horror movie is the music. Because the way the shot's set up, the way that Bert stands out of the shadows,
with
puts the pipe in his mouth,
mm-hmm.
and like the music is still like our melodramatic kind of Quantum Leap soundtrack as opposed to like, you know, a slasher flick. But I swear...
And it's all MIDI keyboard. That's what I love about
it. It could have been,
But if you change that music just a little bit, all of a sudden, this is...
You
this
put it in a minor chord.
Yeah.
And so is this the pipe moment you were talking about?
No, actually.
Okay, excellent. Okay, excellent. Yeah. We have the same pipe.
All right, cool.
Oh, yeah. I wrote, the pipe is back.
Yeah.
But then I have pipe again.
Yes.
So then he's trying to comfort her on the couch slash get her, and
there's a bottle of wine.
I mean, already, like, he's sitting awfully close to her, like, right off the bat. I'm like, is your radar not going off, woman?
And then,
like,
he kisses her, and then she says no, and then he proceeds to keep trying to kiss her.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wrote Widow Daybreak.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you know, and it was a different time then, which is, like, the shittiest thing to say, but it was. Like, I don't think anyone watching would have been like, rape! Like,
well,
we are today.
No,
but it's like,
speaking of the word rape, I forgot, like, that word
does
get thrown out there a little bit.
And literally, like, as
they call
I was watching
it emotional rape.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Which, hey,
it's a thing.
Right, exactly.
But also, like, he was in the act of starting to act, like, not emotionally, physically
her,
rape her. And especially, like, she literally said the word no.
Mm-hmm.
Like, twice.
But it's that thing of, like, well, she's just playing hard to get. No means yes. And it's just like,
Well, and plus the way that he, like, after she breaks off the first time, because the thing is when he first goes in to kiss her, like, she doesn't even really let him kiss her the first time. Like, she doesn't respond. She doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
She's immediately just like,
And
he's like, oh, but, you know, there's all these emotions. And, like, he's just, like, even the words he's saying, it's like, oh,
yeah, and she's already so fragile because she just left her, you know, she's an emotional wreck.
And then he goes back for it, and now she kind of responds, but even still, she's still like, I don't know. And that's when he just goes goes for it. Like, he unbuttons her dress. He's, like,
for sure.
Hands all over her. Right. Like, all sorts
and
of stuff.
And it's also worth noting, like, his shirt is already pretty unbuttoned at the start of that scene.
Yeah. And then there's the knock on the door, because Sam has gotten there.
He saves the day.
Yeah. Now, we have kind of left out that there was just a quick sort of linking scene to give us the information that Joe knows that Sam has gone to the beach house, because Karen tells him, you know... Because Joe's like, where did David go? And Karen's like, he asked for directions to the beach house.
Yeah.
So we know that Joe
knows. Thinks that
exactly.
Sam is the one, or David is having the affair.
Yeah. So Sam shows up, and Sam drops the knowledge that, you know, he never was married. And that's when he says, you're committing emotional rape.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're a terrible human being.
Well, because like Bert says... Because Bert starts justifying it. It's like, no, it's not what it seems. Like, I put myself in people's place so I can experience their pain, and so I can write from the heart. It's not a crime.
Yeah.
And that's how Sam throws out the line, emotional rape is a crime.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's great, you know. And then,
also, it was going to be actual rape.
Well.
That's another improvised song I just did.
Baby Wants Candy, Saturday night, 9 o'clock.
You know, I will say...
At the second city.
Because, like, had Sam not gotten there... What if it was real rape?
Right?
Yeah.
And here's something that's a little bit more meta, and I'm sure was not the intent, but it is interesting given some of the dialogue that we've had in the past about Sam and his position leaping into these people and at times having to basically be intimate with someone while he's on a lead under those false pretenses. And so it's like, one could, and again, I'm sure the show is not trying to be that meta with it,
no.
but one could wonder as...
The ethics of that.
Well,
yeah.
and as Bert is saying... You know, I'm trying to put myself into other people's shoes and experience what they experience. And that, and it's like, well, that's what Sam does.
Yeah.
And it's like, so, and again, I am firmly on the side of, no, Sam's not doing those things. Like, you know, it's like there's never any sort of, you know, and again, not that malicious intent is required for it to be, you know, that...
Yeah,
an act of rape, but that's it. Anyway, it was just kind of an interesting
in life, so.
right, exactly.
For sure, yeah.
But it was kind of an interesting moment based on the conversations we had,
and to bring you in, and we're going to talk about this in a few weeks because I think there is an episode coming up in a few weeks where Sam is actually very guilty of it.
Oh wow!
But there was an article that came out. I thought it was cracked, and I tried to look it up recently, and I can't find the article online.
I found it where we talked about it that day.
But there's an article out there and. It's not dead serious, it's kind of written tongue-in-cheek, but it does bring up a good point.
Yeah.
It makes the argument that any time that Sam is intimate with someone during leaping, which does happen, that he is technically committing rape.
Yeah.
Because the people
the person,
he's sleeping with, they
don't know that it's him.
They
yeah.
don't know that it's,
say,
that it's him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Right.
Oh, yeah. like I said, in a few
I'm
weeks...
I'm already in the lingo.
Yeah.
Love
and,
it.
And in a few weeks, we're going to come up with an episode where I do think that Sam is actually guilty of that, but we'll...
Yeah.
Catch a falling star.
But so far, it's only had, quote-unquote, emotional rape.
Right.
Yeah.
My other favorite part of the scene is she, like... Irene, like, kind of loses it and goes into hysterics, and he has to do that, like, very 1940s movie thing of holding her wrists, like, her lady wrists, as she's, like...
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, because
she's
going to beat the shit out of Bert.
Oh, yeah,
she smacks him once.
So he grabs
and
her and, like...
Crushes him again.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then he does. He grabs her, and we do the melodrama.
The melodrama.
Paint brushes
like,
him again.
The lady.
Another Bob Ross reference there.
Oh, nice.
Oh, boy.
Anyway.
But, yeah, she's got her, like, limp lady wrist, and he's holding her and like trying to calm her down.
And then, you know, he's comforting her. She's very upset, and she's, you know, I mean, I think at this particular point for her, the thing, you know, to look at it from a different point of view, too, the idea that this grieving woman who has kind of started to come to a place of acceptance in spite of all the guilt that she's feeling and a place where she feels like she can talk about it has been manipulated into doing so by this sexual predator who's you know, going to take her story and make his name off of it by selling this book, and now finds out that this is all bullshit, and now she's standing
because Sam drops, by the way, he's not even married.
So like, man, talk about like just having a lot of shit to deal with.
Yeah.
And then of course it gets even worse because as Sam is kind of just trying to comfort her and say like, hey, it's gonna be okay, and it's all right, Joe shows up.
Yeah.
And Joe's got the line of, you know,
my own brother.
Yeah. And my wife. Yeah. And that's when, you know, and Sam and he turns around and leaves. Sam runs after him. Joe turns around. They start to kind of get into it a little bit.
Yeah.
And then Joe just clocks
him.
Yeah.
And Al is so excited about this.
Yeah.
Al's like, this is great, Sam. This is great. Let him hit
Although,
you again. And he still loves
falls,
her.
Yeah.
Sam falls through Al,
I'll catch you. Yeah, I was like, yeah, don't worry, Sam, I got you.
How expensive must have that special effect been? You know, like, because it was actually fairly well done.
For that,
one did look really good, actually.
They did, yeah.
That one looked a heck of a lot better than some of the others. Like, for instance, in Jimmy, when the forklift drives through him, that one's just so-so. But this one did look really good.
And that one, I really feel it comes down to, like, in shooting everything else, like, how much time do they have to actually, like, go through and shoot that effect later on? Yeah, because some episodes, it looks really great.
Yeah.
Other episodes, it was like, oh, you were cramming to get that done before.
Other episodes, we get, like, Paper Doll Al, where it looks like he's, like, just, like, this one-dimensional kind of, like, you know.
And I think it really all depends on how they lit Dean Stockwell in front of the screen.
Sure, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, so then they fall back in love because Irene sees her husband fighting for her.
Yeah.
It's cliche. But also, I don't know, the dad has, sorry, I keep getting their names wrong.
Joe.
Mm-hmm. Has this really powerful monologue on the beach.
Yeah.
And it's just because he finally, you know, he's up until this point kept it all tight. Oh, well, I gotta work and I'm tight. And then, like, everything has been so short with him and he finally just lets it out and it's like a super powerful monologue. I was like, oh, you're like a for real theater actor.
Yeah.
That, you know, moved to LA. Like, you went to, like, Yale School of Drama. Like,
right? Right, no, and it's interesting. So the actor, by the way, is James Sartorius, and he has done a lot. And actually, it's funny because one of the first things that's mentioned on his IMDb page is that he's a veteran theater actor. He's been around for a long time, and he's worked at, you know, a lot of the California places like Old Globe, La Jolla, like the Center Theater Group, Pasadena Playhouse, all the big ones out there.
I can feel that monologue.
And you know, and he's still working all the way up until this day in television and film as well. It looks like he never really did anything, and, you know, good for him because it means he was probably doing a lot of theater, but he never really did anything as, like, a series regular or anything. He's all, like, just guest spots. I take it back. He was on Dynasty for 14 episodes, and apparently
get those coins.
All right, there you go.
Kids put their college or something. But, yeah, but also his IMDb page I'm watching you scroll is 8,000 pages.
Yeah,
long.
So he's done a lot.
Yeah.
But no, he is. He's great in this scene. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that one of the things that really helps that is the fact that he has been so, like, tight the entire time. We've not gotten a lot of emotion from him. And now it all, you know, the floodgates come open, and he does. He lets out really beautifully. And Irene, who's played by, Terry Hanauer, excuse me. She's great as well. And it's you know, it's a really nice moment. And Sam, of course, is standing there, like, bleeding from the mouth.
Yeah.
He's got this big red mark on his cheek.
But he's still, like,
for
thrilled
sure.
to see them, like...
Yeah. But, Al has the line, too, about, like, wow, Sam, you can really take a punch.
Yeah. But it's one of those... they don't happen a lot, but it's one of those moments where Sam kind of sets up the save.
Yeah.
And then he just, like, steps back. He's like, okay.
Very much becomes the observer, yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting because maybe I was just really emotional this moment morning. I don't know. But, I mean, it got tears for me. Like, I was, maybe it was the hangover.
Clumped. I don't have to use one of my few Jewish words right now.
Yeah.
because then the voiceover comes on and says, like, what became of them, correct?
Before that, real quick, I don't think we actually firmly established that that Irene ends up coming into the scene after, you know, Joe has started punching Sam and is like, no, of course I'm not having an affair with him, and, you know, and then they have this moment of I love you, you know, and she, like, sits down with him and, you know, cradles his face in her hands, and it's just a really nice, you know, tender moment, and then he's got his monologue, which is great. But then Al, this is the coolest thing. Al reveals that the book never got published, that Bert's book never got published, but that Irene and Joe ended up writing a book and it had parents
all over
the country,
deal with grief.
Losing a child and everything. And it's like, oh, that's really great. And then there's this moment where it's like they're expecting that Sam's going to leap any minute, and he doesn't. And that's when, like, Sam's just sort of like knowing,
Shalom.
Like,
Amida's,
but Sam's like, not yet,
Yet.
Like, he knows that there, and I think the nice thing is, I think Sam knows exactly what he has to do.
Yeah.
Then we get to the scene.
It cuts to the funeral,
right?
Which
or the setting of the headstone.
Yeah, the setting of the headstone, and this is where I get beclimbed.
Yeah.
It was just so beautiful.
It really was.
And, like, watching the like, in a non-ironic way, it was just so moving and beautiful.
And then there's this great moment where, and this is kind of what I was talking about earlier about how the episode doesn't necessarily get tied up in this pretty little bow, because Joe is still right.
Yeah, they still lost the son.
And so Joe gets up and kind of walks away, like he needs that solitude. Mm-hmm. And like Sam goes over to him and he's like, "Hey, I think she really needs you right now," pointing at Karen, not Irene, the daughter.
Yeah.
And so and Joe has this great line, he's like, I just don't know if I can.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Sam says the clincher, which is like, "You already lost a son, don't lose a daughter."
Right.
And man, the moment, God, I'm getting choked up just thinking about it right now. And then Joe goes over to Karen. And like, they have this incredible moment, like wraps his arms around her, like picks her up and, you know, is holding her there. And Irene comes over and they all kind of embrace and there's tears and happiness.
Yeah.
And everything. But the thing that's beautiful about it, as Sam leaps out, is you get this sense that it doesn't end here for them, that there's still stuff to do, but that now they're going to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And it just was really, it was a great statement about grief. It was a great statement. I thought it was really well done. And
had he not hugged Karen, Michael Kornblum might have swept in. And he might have done some emotional.
Michael Kornblum.
And we'll talk about this a little bit more next week with Jimmy, is like where Jimmy kind of has like this pseudo action scene tacked onto the end that's not really needed, but they do it to raise the emotional stakes. This episode manages to have a really strong emotional ending. And aside from a couple punches being thrown, like we don't have like the big action rescue set piece.
Yeah.
Right.
It's just, I mean, ultimately it just ends up being a really fine hour of dramatic television.
Yes! Yeah. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah. And we'll talk about it next week with Jimmy, but like going into like recording these two episodes, like Jimmy is one of the more iconic episodes of the series, just him leaping into a person with Down syndrome.
Yeah.
So it's like one of the episodes that is more remembered and known amongst fans.
Because I watched the, like, so is the end of every episode that, or was that just like a next time on?
No, every
episode ends with
where he's going to end up the next time.
Oh, shit!
Yeah, in
this
fact,
episode's going to get real!
The interesting thing is, too, is that the leap outs, they do it so intentionally that even when they're in reruns, they would change the leap out to match the episode.
Oh, to whatever's coming next.
They would do that for the reruns. They did not do it for either the DVD or the Blu-ray release.
Huh.
So, like, there were some episodes that they reran a lot because they were, like, critical darlings and they really wanted people to see these episodes. So when you watch the series on DVD or Blu-ray, you have Sam leap into the same thing three or four times because that was literally the next episode that aired as a rerun the next week. But like Sam said, when they show it in reruns on TV, they will actually take the time to splice together the actual next episode that he goes to.
Yeah, and so, I mean, we'll talk about this briefly, too. So the leap out, he is in, like, pajamas and slippers, kind of upside down next to a bunk bed, and he starts to get up, and that's when a little boy comes in with, like, a ray gun, and he's like, you know, I shot you, you're supposed to be dead.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then he runs off, and then we see a man come in, and he's like, "Jimmy, what are you doing? You gotta get ready," and, you know, and then has the line about, like, "Now remember, if the boss asks you, you know, you're just slow, it's okay," and, you know, Sam gets a glimpse in the mirror, and then Sam has the line, you know, and I think that, again, I said this when we taped Jimmy, so you'll hear it next week. It's interesting because in my memory, Sam saying the words, you know, "I'm retarded," I was cringeworthy in my memory. But then actually watching him say it, I was just sort of like, no, it's, I mean, whether or not you have a problem with the word or not, that's fine.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not going to use it again. I was using it in the context of just saying that that's what he said. But like, he does deliver it with a good deal of, like, sensitivity. Like, he's not, like, it's not like he's sitting there, like, going, like, oh, fuck.
Like, we were talking before. Like,
you know, it's not like the end of Kamikaze Kid, or the beginning of Kamikaze Kid, where he leaps into, like, an acne-ridden teenage kid with braces.
Yeah.
And at the end of that one, like, oh, my God, I'm a dork.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it doesn't end like that.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was talking to you before. My mom has taught, or she's retired now, but she taught special ed for 30-some years, and that was just the clinical term for it.
Yeah,
it wasn't a pejorative. I mean, people used it as a pejorative, but it wasn't one. And so that's the term that she used, and still uses, really. I mean, when factually describing someone as whatever, which also Down syndrome is not that.
Right.
So it's like, there's, you know, differences there, but Yeah, it's in the time, and that's why I didn't even think twice when Sam said it.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh yeah, it's just what this guy would have thought, and that's what it was called.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, right. So, yeah, so they have it. There's the leap out. There's
yeah.
the leap out.
I'm
going to
say,
final
yeah.
thoughts?
Oh, wait. Like I said,
wait. I'm so sorry. We built it up like the whole damn episode. We didn't even get to it. When Sam interrupts the two of them, they're on the couch, and Bert has been, like, making moves.
Oh,
he's
yes.
got his hands all
the
over.
Pipe moment,
shoots
yes.
are coming off, blah, blah, blah. Sam interrupts. Irene buttons, goes to the door. The next time we see Bert, he's got his pipe
he's
in his hand.
Back.
Yeah, he's like, I felt like he was kind of like, I gotta look normal.
Bert,
I gotta look normal.
Where's
like,
my
we're
pipe?
Doing normal.
Pipe.
Oh,
yeah.
here's my pipe.
Yeah.
We
yeah.
were just...
Yeah.
talking and piping.
And he just so nonchalantly just kind of sticks it back in his mouth,
yeah.
you know, and it's like, I'm just standing here with my pipe, looking like Bob Ross,
oh
you know, like,
God.
Yeah. So
Bert.
There was the pipe moment.
There we go.
I'm so sorry.
We almost got away.
We are, yeah.
Anyway, I was going to say, like, yeah, coming into, like, watching these two episodes, like, because I remember, like, in my memory, like, this episode kind of being like, eh, and Jimmy, like, being a really strong episode, but I'm like, I feel like out of the two, like, this is the stronger...
Yeah.
Episode of the two.
I think you're
like,
right.
Like, the other one is more iconic, because it's always iconic, like, when they have Sam leap into a black person for the first
right.
time, for
mm-hmm.
a woman for the first time,
yeah.
you know, for someone with, you know, with a disability,
yeah.
you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Somebody with a missing limb, or,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah absolutely. There are... Yeah.
Spoilers!
Yeah, well, yeah. but yeah, I agree. It, in a way, it's interesting, because we even talked about with Jimmy how, you know, I think that in lesser hands... our advertisers, it would have been like a very special episode of Quantum
sure.
Leap. Mm. Yeah, and you could argue almost that in some ways that Thou Shalt Not could have been marketed that way too,
yeah.
sure.
you know, but obviously it's not, thank goodness. But yeah, I agree. I think that this ends up standing out. And honestly, in some ways it might literally be one of my favorite episodes of the season.
Yeah, it was so well acted.
Interesting. Right. I don't know if I'm going to put it up to favorite episodes of the season.
Sure.
But it's up there.
Yeah. There's just some really good stuff in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's just some good moments that are happening all over. And it's interesting, too, because I feel like in this episode, we don't get necessarily a lot of great, like, Al moments, and Al doesn't have some moments, but in Jimmy, we get some really great...
He makes up for it with his ties.
Well, that's, yes, indeed.
Just
tie,
so much gold to make!
Loud shirt, tie, and vest.
Yeah.
It's like, those are the staples. All you gotta do and make it look like, you know, a
yeah.
confetti room blew up
yeah.
on him, and you're good.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. Fantastic.
All right. Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Again,
enjoy.
Where can people find you in Chicago?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't want them to find me.
I'm sorry, I put that in an awkward
yeah.
way. Like Bert showing up with the pipe and
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Baby Wants Candy and Chico's Tops. And we're on Facebook as Chico's Tops.
Fantastic.
Fantastic.
Love
awesome.
It.
All right, we will see you next week for Jimmy.
That's right. Cool. We're out of here.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed what you've heard or have any questions or comments, don't be shy. Reach out to us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And remember to hit the subscribe button and leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may be listening. Until next time. Can't see, you'll never know how.